Hello, and you're listening to Stages. I'd like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
And now it's time for Stages.
All the world's a stage.
It's where we talk about
all things theatrical.
It's about theatre.
Theatre makers.
If it's performing on a stage, we've got it for you here on Stages.
It's about half an hour long.
Okay, let's get on with the show.
Hello, yes, it is time to talk theatre. I'm Regina Botras and I am so excited to welcome my guest this evening. It is Glenn Hazeldine. He has been a regular on our stages for nearly three decades. He studied at NIDA and his first professional gig was with Sydney Theatre Company, performing in David Williamson's Dead White Males. And I think I may have even very well been in the audience, showing my age there. It was directed by the then artistic director, Wayne Harrison. Since then, Glenn has worked consistently, stomping the board across town, and I have seen him in many of these productions, not all of them, but to name just a few, he was in No Pay, No Way, Away, Arcadia, Love and Information, After Dinner, Porn Cake, Happiness, A Hoax, The Pig Iron People, Don's Party, Rhinoceros, All My Sons, and so many more. He is a much loved actor, as well as a tireless advocate for actors. He is the vice president of the New South Wales branch of Actors Equity, and he sits on the National Performers Committee. He is also the deputy chair of the Actors Benevolent Fund. It's so important. Please welcome Glenn Hazeldine.
Hello, good evening. I think we've probably finished there.
No, there's so much more I want to know about you and your life and how you came to this stage. First of all, let's start right at the beginning. Where did you grow up and were you born into a creative household?
Short answer, absolutely not. I'm the only person in my family that really pursued any sort of creative career or even as a pastime, really. I grew up in Lake Macquarie, it was Newcastle at the time, but it became its own city when I was a child. My mum still lives in the house out there at Toronto and West Lake Macquarie in a Wobbegal land. And I went to Newcastle Uni after leaving Toronto High School, where I studied, essentially I studied drama, although I didn't do very well academically back then. But I'd always felt, from high school that there was something about performing. I grew up in a housing commission area at Toronto West, and it was always a place that I knew I had to get out of. And I felt that from, those early days at high school doing school plays, that there was an escapism in doing plays and musicals. But there was also something about the kind of attention that it brought. People really seem to appreciate what I was doing in those little roles in those early days. And somehow, as people say, they caught the bug, and that's when it happened for me.
So do you remember that moment, that bug moment? Was there a particular performance or just was it just the people's reactions to you?
No, I think it happened. I remember lining up at the school canteen and I went up to get my pie, and I remember the woman, one of the mothers at the tuck shop saying, "Oh, we saw you in the school play last night. You're fantastic." And it was the first time anybody had ever kind of any stranger had ever given me any positive affirmation. Growing up in that housing commission area, it wasn't always the healthiest environment for kids. And so there was something, I really do remember this feeling of, oh my God, I feel elevated by that attention and that regard. So I honestly do remember from that moment on thinking, yeah, this is where I feel right.
And they've been doing it ever since. So, but there must be something about growing up kind of in sort of low socioeconomic that makes you kind of real and see, I would say real, everyone's life is real, but I don't know, the stories of our times in a way, you were witness to maybe human nature? I don't know.
I think there is something in it. It was predominantly single mothers in our little area. Certainly in our street, there were very few men, and if there were men around, they were shift workers, My dad left home when I was about four, and there were four of us kids, and my mum, and we had no family. My mum was an only child. My dad was from New Zealand. He went back to New Zealand. So we didn't have a family network. We had great-grandparents, I remember, who lived at Katara, and they were pretty much our only kind of close family, apart from this, you know, my mum's second cousins or whatever. So it was a pretty tough environment. It was great. I mean, I'm still friends with the neighbours that I grew up with, and indeed, Mrs. Haynes still lives three doors up the road from my mum. And I mean, it's like family, really, that relationship. And slowly over the decades, various matriarchs from those neighbours' houses have passed away, which is very sad. But there is still a pretty close bond between the families. But yeah, it wasn't an easy time. You know, we didn't have any money. My mum was a pensioner with no support. Yeah. And we didn't have particular luxuries. I mean, of course, it's a relative term. You make your own. But when I think back, it was really hard on my mum. And having four kids who were all 1 year apart wasn't easy for her. So it wasn't always the happiest home life either. And my family, we're very volatile people. We're very emotional and distrusting still. And I'm sure it has something to do with those formative days.
Distrusting. How do you mean?
We really test our friendships. And my friends are constantly saying this of me today. Still, I'm 50 and my friends still say, well, you push us away. And it's something to do with not being confident that there is that we belong, you know, that we are legitimate. And I think, well, for me, I don't know, I can't speak to my surviving brother and sister, but it's something to do with never being certain that I actually belonged, that I was, you know, that there was substance to my, sorry, this is going to get all very depressing, but there was much substance to my part in the community, which is, I think, why I'm driven to take such responsibility for my sorority and fraternity with the Benevolent Fund and the union work, because I really do value community. It's really important to me. Mm. And I want to be a part of it. Mm. So I guess I do take some responsibility for ensuring its well-being.
Do you feel the community then as a consequence of, you know, the work that you do, but also the industry, because it can be seen as being quite, I don't know, cutthroat and like, I want the gig, and there's so many more actors today than probably when you started. Like, what's that like?
Yeah, I think, you know, from the outside, I guess it is it would appear to be a very competitive industry, but it is a great one to be a part of. It actually, I would say it's a privilege to be amongst this community, because when all is said and done, we do work in a very peculiar way. You know, a rehearsal room is really just sitting around and talking about life and your life and the rules of life. That's what you do in a rehearsal room. You're trying to understand why people behave the way they do. We don't just get up on the floor and randomly act something out and that'll do. We're constantly probing to find out what it is that makes these people behave in this way at that time, you know, the time in which the production is set, and what are the rules of their world. And you can only understand the rules of the theatrical world, but if you really do analyze the rules of life. So rehearsals really are sitting around and talking about your life. Mm. And that's a great, you know, it's a very, it has to be a completely trusting environment. And so I think what we get to do that the general public maybe don't often get the chance to experience is to talk intimately about what's happening inside us and what's happened to us in our lives.
So what is that relationship between your experience and then this, I guess, microcosm of a world that you are acting inside of? Are you always bringing something of you in there, or does it exist itself? Are you always casting a role too, I suppose, as something that you relate to?
Yeah, that's interesting. I won't speak for other actors, because everybody has a... importantly, everybody has an approach that works for them. But for me, I only ever feel that I can play myself. I don't. I remember reading when I was at drama school, one of our texts, guiding texts for the acting stream was Uta Hagen's Respect for Acting. And she very clearly articulated something that I've always carried. And that is that I reject personally, I don't reject it as an approach for others, but for me, I reject the idea that that one loses themselves in a character. Rather, they find themselves in the character. So for me, it's important for me to understand the character, to really go through the script and understand the circumstances for that person, let's say, and then me find what connects me to them. So I've never murdered anybody, but I have experienced something close to a murderous intent, you know, or rage or something that I can start to understand what it is about me that makes me behave in the way, or, you know, maybe compelled me to behave in a way similar to the character. So I'm constantly trying to find a way to make myself the character rather than to create something that's independent of me. I can't experience anything that I haven't, you know, I can't pretend to necessarily. So I've got to try and find little correlations between my own experiences and the character. And then I build on that. Is that making any sense?
Yeah. It must be quite, you know, fun and liberating to play. How do you walk away from a role that some kind of huge emotional turmoil or something? Do you have a way to transition out?
Again, this is everybody's approach is very different. For me, I can throw myself into it at the time. And, you know, rehearsals are 4 or 5 weeks of going over and over and over things. So it's not like you're surprised by what's happening when you're playing the circumstances of the show. You've been through it many times and you've talked about it a lot, and you've also had private conversations with the performers that you're working with. But for me, there's some, you know, I'm very aware of the artifice. You know, you come off stage and you walk into a pretty rustic, you know, wing environment. You know, there's no bells and whistles backstage. It's you know, it's certainly at the Opera House, you go back there and there are pipes everywhere, and there are, you know, garbage bins around the place, and there are you know, labels on black tubes running up the wall that say sewage. So it's not, you know, the artifice is very clear. So for me, I walk off stage and I know that whatever happened on stage is very different to the practical world that I've re-entered. So I don't think I've ever really had a problem coming out of a role. However, in the exploration of a character and the exploration of a play and the experience of doing a play, things do come up that are quite confronting emotionally. You know, you do, it's not, the emotions are real. My involvement in a high stakes drama is very, what's that word? Visceral. But for me, it's very rare that I've ever felt discombobulated coming off stage. I think that's very clear to me when you see your mates backstage and you know, you pick up on the jokes that you were making before you went on stage, that it's a separate thing. But other people have a very different education and a very different experience.
It's a clear line between each. Do you think being an actor has taught you kind of philosophical ways of living? Like, I imagine it's basically kind of what you're saying in a way is also you understand acting as being so present that you have to be addressing what's exactly in front of you. Is there kind of what has it taught you kind of as a person?
You would hope that would be so, but you know, I'm 50 and I'm completely dysfunctional. I did do a well-being seminar a couple of years ago in Melbourne, with an excellent seminar, and I do know her, but her name has just popped out of my head because I wasn't prepared for this. But she was talking about what it is to be a performer, and she's a performance psychologist. You know, she's a psychologist who specializes in the circumstances for creative people, the creative state, which is a, you know, in terms of brain function, is a very particular way of working. And she was talking about this skinlessness that performers by nature or creatives are skinless. You know, they don't want to put a buffer between themselves and the ugliness of life, because you've got to understand the ugliness in order to be able to play the story. So she talks about that we absorb a lot of dark materials, you know, a lot of because that's what fuels the creative state. But she, you know, she was sort of articulating that can create all sorts of flow and effects. And she said, and this is, I'm trying to answer your question, why there's so much dysfunction in my own personal life. It's because she says, so for an actor or a performer to receive a compliment takes longer than somebody who works in the bank. So when somebody says to a performer, "Oh, I thought you were great in that show," they deflect it very quickly because they're very used to hearing people say, yeah, I wasn't wild about what you did. You know, 30 people might say, you were fantastic, but the one person who says, yeah, it didn't really work for me is the one that you remember for the rest of your life. Mm. And the reviews that say, amazing, what a star, what a brilliant performer, disappear very quickly. But the review that says, you know, the standout for worst performance of the night was Glenn Hazelding, you cannot let that go. You kind of... because you're so vulnerable, you know, you're putting a lot out on the line. So you're very susceptible to the criticism. And so we do become very, very unusually defensive people, or I am. And this theory was that, and it's interesting, that it takes something like 17 to 22, and I've forgotten the number, I didn't prepare, but, you know, you need to have that compliment reinforced for about 20 seconds before it really roots itself and takes hold.
Wow.
Whereas any negative criticism takes a second. You hear it, you hold it.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I've practiced this with friends, you know, performing, friends who are performers, by, you know, talking about something I've seen them do. And I make sure that I keep going for about 20 seconds and keep articulating how wonderful I thought they were and how I don't know how they did it and I wish I had that ability. And at about the, you know, 15 to 17 second mark, something happens on their face where they just start to relax and glow. And it's because they're stopping the defensive thing of hearing something positive because they know that the fall is about to come. And it's quite fascinating. So there's, look, probably, I wish I was a more well-adjusted person, and I work hard at it, and I'm trying to, you know, improve myself every day. But I think my close friends would say, yeah, no, you're just as difficult as you ever were.
Is this a bad thing to ask? Is there something that, you know, you still remember that bad review, and how did you cope with it? Like,
it's actually easy to talk about. It's just the sad truth. Yes, of course I remember the bad reviews. Of course I do. I remember it not so long ago, in fact, doing a play. We were doing a co-production between the Sydney Theatre Company and the Melbourne Theatre Company. And I'm not going to mention the play because I know somebody out there will go and Google it to read it. But I'll tell you the reviewer, the Melbourne reviewer, you know, described my involvement in the play as, you know, by far the only kind of downside of having to sitting through the show was having to put up with my performance. And I'll never forget it. And I've had fantasies of, you know, meeting this guy, and it was a male writer.
And what would you do?
Spilling all sorts of things over it, ranging from alcohol to effluent. You definitely hold on to that stuff. And I know, and I've had other creative folk, relate directors, writers say the same thing. It is tricky, but you definitely hold on to those ones.
Oh, heartbreaking. How do you cope? No wonder. I'm really curious about that brain functioning. What is the difference between a performer and the bank person? What is that? Is it just that kind of need to, because you are putting everything on show?
Yeah. It's our job to reveal, you know. People in everyday life, a bank teller doesn't have to reveal anything to a customer. It's actually not helpful to them or the customer.
Mm.
It may slow things down. It may complicate things. It may confuse people or create a strange experience, you know, an unhelpful corporate experience for somebody. But our job is to open up the, you know, those, to delve into those darker corners of our makeup.
Mm.
So, and there can only be some effect to that. You know, I can't see how it's possible for there not to be some ongoing effect of that approach to your working life. And you know, when you're rehearsing a play, it's not just the, you know, 10 o'clock till 6 p.m. that you're in the room, you know, practically rehearsing. You're exploring it all the time. You explore it walking through the street. You know, you're turning over it as you head home from work. You're learning lines all night. You know, it's with you. You're delving a lot.
Yeah.
So maybe it's possible to not experience, you know, to create a defense mechanism that stops dark, you know, influences getting into you, but I don't know how to do. I haven't worked that out yet.
Well, you have to tell me a good review now. Come on. There must be hundreds and hundreds. Let me talk for 20 seconds. I want to ask you about the work that you're doing with the Actors Benevolent Fund and the Actors Equity, all of that work. Talk to me about how it's going for actors out there and you know, the kind of help that people can get.
Look, it's let's face it, it's been a really rough 18, approaching 2 years. And by the time we fully reopen, it will be almost 2 years since the pandemic hit. And the arts sector was the first to close. Yeah. And it'll be amongst the last industries to fully reopen.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was saying earlier that performers or creatives, writers that are the same, they have the same experience. Getting paid to do it is not always easy. People often ask you to do favors for free.
Yeah.
So it's not a job that most of us do because it's lucrative. We do it because we have to, because there's nothing else we can do. It's a compulsion. It's an addiction. Mm. It's an addiction. So when something like COVID hits and the industry closes down, there's no income. There's no way to make income. And a lot of performers, a lot of creatives often make their money by work, you know, their secondary income from hospitality. Yeah. But that's all gone as well.
Yeah.
For me, I came out of high school and went to uni, and I did three years at Newcastle Uni. I failed, but I was doing plays all the time. And then I auditioned for drama school in Sydney and went to NIDA. And then I spent 3 years studying at NIDA, and then I went straight into the business. I don't have transferable talent, you know, skills. I worry that, you know, I'm at 50. I could do entry level stuff for somebody, but I'm not particularly skilled. And a lot of performers are the same. When in the absence of being able to make money doing what we know how to do, it's a really tricky life. And so working for the Actors Benevolent Fund, and I've been on the committee for about 11 years now, the Actors Benevolent Fund of New South Wales, I'm very aware that when somebody comes to us, everything's confidential, of course, so I can't talk about any particular, you know, particular way that we've helped people. When people come to us, I'm very aware of, you know, the degree of mental health struggle that very often an applicant for financial assistance is saying, look, I'm seeing a psychologist. Mm. I run out of my Medicare allowance and I don't want to not see them. I'm really struggling at the moment. So we spend a lot of money every year paying for people's mental health care. Mm. We've also devised programs with Actors Equity, creating content that we put online, mindfulness, you know, this woman that I was telling you about, and I'm ashamed of myself for not remembering her name. I've been trying to Google it as we speak. You know, trying to get some content out there that can be helpful to people. We've been buying meditation courses so that we can provide them for free. We're buying people groceries because we just got to get food into bellies. You know, we've spent in New South Wales alone, hundreds of thousands of dollars buying groceries and petrol and essentials for our community. It's been a really trying time for the committee. Mm. We're a committee of, I think, 14 or between 12 and 14 of us there all the time, working out ways to make money, working out ways of reaching people, and then also assessing their applications for assistance. And it's never been a busier time. But also, having said that, the response from the community to any requests for donations has been incredible. Mm. And I've got to take my hat off to the Sydney Theatre Company in particular, who put the Actors Benevolent Fund of New South Wales side by side with their own attempts to fundraise in order to keep that company afloat. And so the generosity of STC audiences has been extraordinary. The money that has been given, and you know, we're all volunteers as the committee, so when money comes in, pretty much every cent of it goes to helping people who need it.
It's great, but it's hard to ask for help, I'm sure. You know, that's sort of probably part of the, you know, barrier.
It's so true. It's absolutely true. And part of the, you know, when COVID hit, part of our initial struggle as a committee, of the Actors Benevolent Fund of New South Wales, was creating, we created some content. You know, Kate Blanchett came in and helped us with an online campaign of, we got writers and directors and stage managers and performers, and we put together a whole series of online content saying to people that it's okay to ask for help. Mm. Because what a performer will do, we're used to kind of you know, not making a lot of money and struggling through the hard times. We're very match fit in that regard. So often the first response when I say to somebody who I'm aware is, you know, maybe struggling a bit, I say, you know, you can come to the Benevolent Fund, you know, it's all confidential and there is assistance there if you need it. And they say, oh, look, I think I'll be okay. You know, I'm sure other people need it more than I do. And that was the most overriding comment that we heard at the time was, oh, yeah. Look, I'll wait because I think other people will need it more. And what I've looked, you know, what's happened, you know, since COVID hit is organizations like the SBW found the SBW Foundation and Sydney Theatre Company and Ian Darling and all these amazing people have gifted us chunks of money that means that and the City of Sydney indeed that means that we have the resources. It's not like people are going to exhaust the fund by asking for help. We've got money there to help people. It's just getting them to accept it that's difficult. We're a very proud people, you know, we're a very resilient, creative community. So getting people to actually allow their hand to sit out there as we put a voucher or a, you know, a pay their car registration or their electricity bill or whatever, having them hold their hand out long enough to get that assistance in there has been a struggle, I have to say.
And you made a good point, of course, to remember that it's not just the people that are in front on the stage, it's all the people behind the stage. There's so many people involved in making theatre and bringing it to life and who are struggling. So yeah, please reach out if you can. So how, from your projection, what do things look like? I'm starting to get emails of things projected to be opening. What do you foresee from your perspective?
I can see that the film and TV world is slow, is happening. You know, there are not a whole lot in New South Wales at the moment, but certainly in Queensland, a number of projects in the film and television arena that have been happening. My best buddy is a casting director, Kirsty McGregor, and I know that she's been quite busy. So there's a great deal of optimism there. Theatre, of course, is a different kettle of fish because theatre relies on hundreds of people coming in to look at it. So it'll be a little while. It's, you know, I've started to see that in November, it looks like things late October, November, some musicals and things will start to get back onto the stages. I know that various theatre companies, I won't give anything away specifically because it's a movable feast, but I know that there are various theatre companies that are projecting towards a sort of late October, November reawakening, which will be great. But then the downside of that is often that's product that's been happening for the last couple of years. You know, there's no new jobs for performers. You either had the job back then or, you know, you got to wait a little while longer before before the seeds germinate and start springing, you know, the bounty starts springing forth. So it's going to be rough. You know, the Benevolent Funders, we know that we've got, it's a long road ahead. You know, there is a glimmer of light at in the tunnel, but we know that we have to work really hard to, and I'm glad you made that observation that the Benevolent Fund, despite the name Actors Benevolent Fund, is an industry-wide fund. So if you make your livelihood by working in the entertainment industry, chances are that the Benevolent Fund can help.
Well, Glenn Hazeldine, thank you so much for joining me today or this evening.
Look, it has been great, a great pleasure, and thank you for all you're doing to keep the movement vital and alive, and to keep the conversation alive. It's really important that society functions better for having art in it. And I'm really grateful that there are people like you out there who recognise that, and you fulfil your part of the deal. You know, art is an interactive experience, and I'm glad that you're there, kind of servicing that essential part of the conversation.
I will. I'll keep talking about it and I'll keep coming to see you on stage as soon as I can. And I think you've found your belonging place, your tribe, Glenn Hazeldine.
Thank you very much. And if you come and see anything, please send a note backstage and I'll buy you a glass of wine.
Well, I look forward to that. Well, that was Glenn Hazeldine, one of our most loved actors. And please, if you are in the industry, do reach out to the Actors Benevolent Fund. They are sure to help you in some way, somehow.
whether that's with vouchers, whether that's with paying a little bit towards bills or some online, do look them up. Actors Benevolent Fund. You've been listening to Stages. That's it from me. I'm Regina Botros. I will see you next week.